Ms. Brennan.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I represent the appellant David Feldman in this matter. Essentially, we want this Court to focus on four issues that we think the District Court erred on in its decision below. First, the District Court erred by finding that we did not present sufficient evidence that Mr. Feldman was substantially limited in sleeping. Secondly, the District Court erred by finding that we did not state a reasonable accommodation claim sufficiently to go to the jury. Third, the District Court erred in finding that we hadn't presented sufficient evidence to show retaliation. And finally, the District Court erred by entering a judgment of sanctions against plaintiff for improperly naming a defendant. I'd like to start first with the evidence that plaintiff presented in the District Court that he is actually disabled. In the District Court, we presented evidence that he suffers from two impairments, fibromyalgia and sleep apnea. The combination of these impairments and the impact that they have on each other creates a substantial limitation in sleeping. We have three types of evidence. We have a sleep study, medical records. We have medical testimony from his doctors, and we have the plaintiff's evidence himself, testimony himself about his substantial limitation in sleeping. This case is not similar or disposed of by the Squibbs, Shearer, or Burks trilogy, because in each of those cases, there was no medical evidence. The only testimony that appeared to be in the record was testimony based on what the plaintiff said, him or herself, only about their substantial limitation in sleeping. And I think in those three cases, the court was applying perhaps a higher scrutiny on dealing with finding somebody substantially limited in sleeping because it is an easy allegation to make and it's difficult to corroborate.
So I have a question for you, though. Suppose we did agree with you that on this record a rational trier of fact could find that the sleep studies and so forth added up to a substantial limitation in that. What I'm interested in your focusing on is how that factors back into his ability to perform the necessary functions of the jobs that existed at Olin, because it's not just because you have a certain disability, even if it's a very severe one, doesn't necessarily mean that that there's a work consequence to it, if I can put it that way.
I think once we can establish that he is covered by the ADA, then he was then entitled to a reasonable accommodation. And we're not asking for him to get a job that he didn't have the seniority to get. Our evidence shows that he had the seniority but to bump into the two baghouse positions that were available at the time he was laid off, and that he was qualified for those jobs.
But what if Olin argues in its brief that the nature of this facility is one that requires workers to be able to shift from one time period to another, work straight shifts or work rotating or swing shifts, and also that there is just some predictable, maybe not very much for some jobs, but some predictable amount of overtime that simply needs to be worked. In other words, it's just a job qualification. Even though one is disabled, it doesn't necessarily mean you're entitled to work every job.
That's right. And that's why we were just seeking accommodations to put him into jobs that were already straight shift jobs. They already have day-only straight shift jobs. That's what he had been working previously.
He's working now?
Yes.
I mean, he's still at Olin, right?
Yes. He had bid on a straight shift job tractor operator position, even though it was a reduction in pay, on his doctor's advice, because that was the rotating shift that he had worked for 30 years was exacerbating his fibromyalgia symptoms to the extent that he couldn't function on that shift. So he bid on a straight day job. So rotating shifts is not an essential function of every job, and we weren't asking them to modify the baghouse jobs or the adjuster jobs from a rotating schedule to a straight day schedule. They were already straight day schedules. And with respect to overtime, I know that the defendant has made the point that within the baghouse, overtime is an essential function of that job. But this court looks at what do the employer's documents say? What do the incumbents actually do? And what is the history in what employees having to perform those functions? And here, in the bag house, the
What is a bag house?
It's my understanding of it, it's a large facility that where bags collect all the dust that is created from the various manufacturing things happening. And then the employees have to go around and they look at the bags to make sure that they're not overflowing. When they are overflowing, they change them. There are also two very large bags that have to be changed, but only once every 12 to 14 months. And those are the ones that require the employee to go up on the ladders. That's my understanding. The plaintiff has worked in the bag house. And his testimony, unrebutted, is when there has been a fire in the bag house, which is part of defendant's reason for saying that overtime is an essential function of the job, they've called people from other places in the plant, including the plaintiff. He's actually been called from his whatever position he's working on to go to the bag house to assist with fires. So I don't think that the risk of a fire, although you know a serious risk, is sufficient to justify overtime as an essential function of that
particular
job.
And this was the job that has only been historically 3 to 6 hours a year.
Exactly.
Anyway, yeah.
We also presented evidence that in 2007, the two of the straight day employees that were actually working in that job, one worked under 9 hours of overtime the entire year. The other one worked a similarly low number. In 2008, which would have been, in 2008, both of those employees worked approximately 2 hours of overtime. So I just don't think that the evidence is sufficient to show that the bag house required overtime. And I think that we have certainly put forth enough evidence to call that into question and create a factual issue that is for the jury to decide. I'd like to go back to the evidence that we did put in about his substantial limitations and less. That's right. The sleep study that we submitted showed that during a given night, Mr. Feldman slept less than 50% of the time, and it took him an hour to fall asleep. And during that time, he had 13 apneas, which is a stop breathing for at least 10 seconds. Extrapolated to an 8-hour night's sleep, we're talking about him getting 3.5 hours of sleep per night.
Was this a study conducted by his general practitioner? Who did the study?
His general practitioner ordered it, but it's done at a sleep study facility. Okay. And then they report the results to the general practitioner. So in this 3.5 hours of sleep, extrapolating that information, he has 45 apneas in 3.5 hours, which is about every 5 minutes during that time period. I think that evidence, plus the evidence from his rheumatologist and his general practitioner that he suffered, that fibromyalgia causes a sleep disturbance, that he suffered from sleep disturbances, that he suffered from insomnia, that he woke regularly during the night, is sufficient to show that he was substantially limited.
And you also have evidence in the record to show that straight shifts is something that helps address this condition?
Exactly. His doctor told Olin, our defendant, on more than one occasion that the straight shift had been therapeutically effective for the plaintiff before, and that was the thing that would allow him to work. And his doctor actually told him, you know, this is required, told the defendants, this is required to allow him to be a functioning employee.
But what about the CPAP? Why wasn't that something that could have also made him a functioning employee?
First of all, I'd like to point out that the time of the first adverse action is in May of 2007, which is long before, 2 months before the CPAP is actually prescribed, and so his condition, whether or not he's substantially limited, should be looked at, I contend, at that particular time. That's what the law says. You look at the time of the adverse action. And the CPAP does assist, but there's also evidence in the record that shows that he's fighting it, that he's not tolerating it well, and evidence from him that he is continuing to have sleep difficulties. And in fact, what his doctor said was, if he can work the first shift and with the use of a CPAP, he should be able to remain a functioning employee, you know, contributing and supporting himself. So although the CPAP did and can address some of those issues, it doesn't, I don't think, defeat his claim that he was substantially limited in sleeping. We also presented a claim that he was regarded as substantially limited in working. Based on the evidence we presented was that the defendants thought he could not work any position in the plant. There are dozens of positions in the plant, from maintenance worker, janitor, tractor operator, baghouse operator, etc. They're listed in their collective bargaining agreement. And they also mistakenly thought or exaggerated his actual limitations to say that he also couldn't reach overhead, but he had no overhead reaching restriction. They thought that he couldn't climb. They thought he actually had a climbing restriction, and that was one of the bases they claimed he couldn't work in the baghouse. That just wasn't accurate. He never had a climbing restriction.
Before you use up your time, I want to ask whether there is anything left to the sanctions appeal insofar as you're complaining not about the denial of your own motion, but the district court's ruling on the Rule 11 imposing the $13,000 and some costs or the attorney's fees, because there's some pretty serious jurisdictional arguments that have been raised.
Yes, and so there is no question that we have preserved our appeal in the court's denial of our motion.
Your own
for
motion.
Right.
Yeah.
So our contention is that Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4A4 saves the appeal for the
4A4? 4A4 tolls the time to appeal, but this appeal wasn't affected by a tolling rule. This appeal is premature. The district court didn't quantify the sanction until February 22nd. Notice of appeal was filed more than 2 months before that. And it was filed by Feldman rather than by the lawyer who was ordered to pay the fees. So you've got two problems. One, the notice of appeal doesn't appear to pertain to the sanction award. And two, it seems to be by the wrong party. You need to discuss both of those problems.
So I think the court is correct. The February 22nd order issuing the amount of attorney's fees and costs was not appealed, and it's...
Well, it was appealed, but this court has already dismissed that appeal
right.
for want of jurisdiction.
And
what I have problems with is the idea that the appeal 2 months earlier, which was addressed to the merits judgment, can concern the sanctions award when the appeal from the sanctions award has already been dismissed.
But in our case, we appealed the sanctions order that was issued in November.
You cannot appeal a sanctions order until it is quantified. It wasn't quantified until February. So the notice, there's only one way in which the notice of appeal could work, and that's the springing provision of Rule 4A2. Two courts of appeals have considered this issue, and they've both held that 4A2 does not save a premature notice of appeal filed before a sanctions award is quantified. You don't discuss those cases. We would have to create a conflict in the circuits to rule in your favor. Is there some reason why you think that 4A2 applies?
I think that 4A4 applies because...
4A4 is irrelevant. I've already told you that. It's 4A2 or nothing.
But this court's decisions in Casertino's dealt with a 4A4 provision where they said the earlier filed appeal, though the amount wasn't quantified.
Might have been relevant to your second appeal, but that's already been dismissed. We don't have that. What we have is a notice of appeal that was filed 2 months before the award is quantified, not a notice of appeal that was filed afterward, but with some kind of tolling motion.
And I guess I'm my position is as I read the rules, that 4A4 also acts to have a premature appeal spring forward.
Well, that's two.
That's two.
I mean, and there are some springing forward rules, and your problem is that what these other courts have said is that when there's a sanctions motion, the springing process doesn't work. You have to have the dollar amount. Now, I could understand a world in which you might say you don't care what the dollar amount is. You don't think the order should have been there at all. But that's not the direction these other courts have taken. They perhaps think that the amount of money may affect somebody's decision whether to appeal. I don't know. I mean, there are a number of reasons why you might go one way or the other.
The notice of appeal filed here was like filing a notice of appeal from a district court statement that he's going to award summary judgment to your opponent, but before the damages are quantified. And Rule 4A2 doesn't work in that situation either. 4A2 works when the judge has announced the final decision but hasn't entered the judgment. And saying, I'm going to award sanctions, but not saying how much, is not an announcement of the final decision.
Okay, then under 4A2, our position is that because we timely appealed that, because we filed a notice of appeal as to the November 29th order.
You mean Feldman?
The plaintiff,
lawyers,
yes.
Lawyers, of course, didn't.
The plaintiff did. That decision becomes final when the district court quantifies
the award. You want us to create a conflict among the circuits. Would you explain why, in your view, the other circuits are wrong?
Because in this instance, I think that...
Instance doesn't concern the interpretation of the meaning of Rule 4A2. You have to have an argument about what Rule 4A2 means.
My understanding from reading first here is that 4A2 is intended to allow the person who mistakenly but wrongly thinks that the decision is final to save that particular notice of appeal and have it finalized.
First here doesn't say that. First here says that Rule 4A2 is about people who think the judgment has been entered, but they're surprised to discover it hasn't been. It is not about allowing people who don't understand the meaning of a final decision to appeal before one has even been announced.
Well,
in fact, First Tier expressly rejected that line of argument.
I would contend that based on the cases that are in the Seventh Circuit, which are the SEC versus McNamee, McCarter, and A. Bauer Mechanical, and A. Bauer Mechanical, actually, to me, is right on point, because when I read that, it appears that the plaintiff filed his notice of appeal before the attorney's fee award was quantified. And the court found that it nonetheless, the earlier filed appeal sprang forward and saved that appeal.
Okay, so I think we know what your position is. I have one other question for you about your own motion for sanctions, because that doesn't suffer from all of these things. It was simply denied. It's here. It's my understanding that you think they should have been sanctioned for violating Rule 11C2 because they did not follow the mandatory language of that rule to present their assertion to you so that you could have withdrawn this other defendant in a timely manner and avoided the problem.
That is part of...
So that would be an offsetting sanction, assuming that it's too late to do anything about the other ones?
That's part of our contention, that they didn't follow the safe harbor proceedings, but also that the evidence was such that the filing of the Rule 11 in the first instance was frivolous. Our clients, the documents they produce show Global Brass as the employer. Our clients gets paid from Global Brass. Their ADA policy is on Global Brass letterhead that they produced to us during the litigation. Their own attorneys wrote us letters saying, Global Brass is prepared to, et cetera. And, I mean, not to be flip, but even in their submission to this court on appeal as to who's the proper defendant, they refer to themselves as Global. So I don't think our having left them in the case is even remotely sanctionable based on the evidence that we had at the time. And I think that there's some evidence that their Rule 11 motion was for an improper purpose. And I just want the court to review the evidence. Thank you.
Mr. Wath.
May it please the court, I'd like to start with a few things that I don't think there can be any real argument about. First of all, this case does not involve a permanent job loss, as response to your question, Judge Wood. This whole case is about a six-month layoff in 2007.
But that's an adverse job
it
action.
It is, and I concede that, but that's all that's involved. Secondly, there is no claim, and there is certainly no evidence here, that this job curtailment was directed against this plaintiff or was in bad faith in any way. 12 jobs were eliminated or realigned, not just the plaintiffs.
Well, he's not saying that. He's saying it's because he was disabled, because you weren't paying attention to his sleep disorder and not accommodating that during that seven-month period. So that's the question.
He was accommodated. Well,
let's focus on this summary judgment. Obviously,
yeah.
You certainly have arguments. I perfectly understand that he was accommodated. But the threshold question is whether there was a genuine issue of fact about whether he was disabled. And he does present quite a bit of serious medical evidence to suggest that he has a severe sleep disability.
Your Honor, I would suggest that the first issue and the dispositive issue is whether or not there was any knowledge on the part of the defendant.
No, the first issue is whether he's disabled, because if he's not disabled, then no one cares whether you know anything or not.
His testimony here and the evidence that he submitted does not get beyond the trilogy of Squibb, Shearer, and Burke that we brought forth, dealing with the inability to. In those cases, the plaintiff was unable to sleep more than 3 to 4 hours a night, and that was deemed insufficient to create a substantial limitation
right,
on a major
but,
life
but,
activity.
But the evidence was quite different. So, for example, in Burke's, there were no medical records or other evidence to demonstrate or to back up Ms. Burke's assertion of her disability. The same problem existed in Squibb. We criticized her generalized assertions, whereas Mr. Feldman's case is one with objective support.
Prolonged, severe, and long-term. And the only evidence of this sleeping disability appears in some diary that he was keeping.
He had a sleep study.
Known to anyone else. That sleep study came after the layoff, as she just pointed out. There was no way we could have known about that.
Well, you're muddling questions. There is a question about whether there is evidence in the record that he had a disability. I entirely agree with you. If we decide that there are disputed issues of fact on that, there are a number of other hurdles that he would have to surmount before this case could go forward. One was, did he let you know? You know, was there a proper opportunity for the company to engage in the kind of accommodation process that we've discussed in many cases? You know, was the company, in fact, is there any genuine issue of fact on whether what you did satisfied whatever? You know, they're not, so in other words, it helps to take these issues one at a time.
Well, and in response to that, let me say that I think the reason that the standard is so high in these sleeping cases is because many people in the population have sleeping problems. Many people have sleeping problems from time to time, and they go away and they come back. And you know, you have to show that you've got a real, real big problem.
Well, I don't
and
see
I don't
why.
Think, I don't think his that the testimony. There's a lot of phrases used about was unable to sleep tonight, I'm having trouble sleeping, and so forth. The doctor said that his fibromyalgia made his sleeping problems difficult, but I don't think it rises to the standard of the cases. Indeed,
So you don't think sleep apnea is actually a problem?
No, sleep apnea is a problem.
Of course it is. There are sleep disorder clinics at most major hospitals that are able to document exactly how much somebody sleeps. And somebody who hasn't, I'm not even sure Olin wants somebody who hasn't slept well operating certain kinds of machinery, but that's another issue.
All right. May I go on then to...
Please, yeah.
I'd like to go on to the knowledge issue, Your Honor. The statute provides only bars discrimination against a qualified individual with a disability because of the disability.
Well, and let's separate out whether there's a discrimination claim or whether there's a failure to accommodate claim. Those are different.
Well, I think this entire case is a failure to accommodate claim. I don't think there's any claim of discrimination in the sense that I believe you're talking about.
I think that's probably right.
There was no sleeping disability pleaded in this case. The first time it arose was in response to the motion for summary judgment. So the chronology is that Dr. Green wrote this letter on May 2, which was delivered to the company by the plaintiff on May 21, and recommended straight days because of an underlying medical condition. It made no mention of any sleeping problem. The company laid the plaintiff off right after the receipt of that letter on May 21 because there were no positions available that met all the restrictions that the letter imposed. And then the first time the company was told the plaintiff had any sleeping difficulties was in Dr. Green's letter of June 4, 2007, where he talked about the need to have a stable sleep cycle. That was 2 weeks after the layoff occurred. And his first mention of sleep apnea was in a letter of July 10, 2007.
So what would it do to this case if we said Olin hasn't done anything wrong for sure up until July 10?
Well,
but there were other positions, for example, this baghouse thing.
No, I'm sorry, Judge. The baghouse position, well, there are two groups of jobs. One group of jobs he applied for were rotating shift jobs. Those were the other tractor operations.
Right. And
so those are rotating shift jobs. The baghouse job is really two. There are two things. There was an opening in late May, right after his layoff, which he did not bid on. His other argument here is that you should have bumped a less senior employee from that baghouse position and given it to me. And that is simply contrary to law. This court decided in a case called Pond versus Michelin, which we've cited, that there is no duty under the ADA to bump even a less senior employee because of the disability claim made by the plaintiff.
You may be right for this CBA, but doesn't it depend on what the general rules are in that plant?
Well, the general rule was that everybody had to work rotating shifts.
It's not what I'm saying about bumping. There are a lot of CBAs that have elaborate bumping provisions.
The plaintiff himself testified, and this is at Appendix 188 and 89, that every job, including the baghouse, required availability for overtime.
But the question is whether we have cases that indicate that there could be, in some instances, I'm not saying it's this, but just as a matter of theory, there could be a genuine issue of fact as to what the real job requirements are. And there's a lot of weight given to what the employer says. But if the employer says, for example, overtime is an absolute requirement for this job, and the evidence showed that for 10 years running, not a single employee had ever been asked to work so much as a single hour of overtime, and I'm deliberately changing the facts here because I don't want you to tell me that how many hours it was. I mean, there could be issues of fact about what the real job requirements are.
Yeah, if it were pretextual.
There could be issues of fact. There could be evidence to show that what the employer is saying is not, in fact, a real job requirement. The employer says you have to have an engineering degree, but they hire lots of people who never went to college to do the job. You would say an engineering degree isn't really.
Well, may I make 2 points in response to that, Judge? One is the CBA itself recognizes that overtime is an essential job requirement. Section 8.
So that's some evidence. Okay.
8.13A of the CBA, which appears at Plaintiff's Appendix 539, states, quote, "It is recognized that overtime work is important and on occasion necessary, and that an employee is subject to disciplinary action for failure to work assigned overtime unless excused by the foreman." That's across the plant. No exceptions for the baghouse or any place else. The other thing I would point out to you is that there is considerable testimony in the record from Olin representatives about the fact that there are overtime occasions when cleaning has not been finished and when there are fires.
Describe for me what you understand the accommodation requirement in the ADA to mean. It sounds to me like you don't think companies have to change anything in order to accommodate. Is that right?
No.
So what do they have to change?
Well, you mean in this case or?
No, in any case. I mean, if employers, in order to accommodate a person with a disability, never have to change a single pre-existing aspect of a job, I'm not sure what the accommodation requirement does.
Well, they have to be able to take reasonable measures. I mean, if in fact there is no real reason to require rotating shifts, and there certainly is in a manufacturing plant, then you should say you can have your we'll put you on a straight shift.
All right. So you're agreeing then that the accommodation requirement does impose on an employer the duty to look at a particular job and see if relaxing one or more of the usual rules would work for this particular for disabled employee X.
And that happened here. That happened here. He was brought back to work in December of 2007, the very first time that he applied for a straight shift job that was vacant. He was, after he got his job back, he complained about having to work in the coil miller. We took him out of the coil miller and put him in one of the jobs that he requested.
Wasn't this after he had filed some complaints and there were some emails indicating that you actually hadn't meant to bring him back?
There aren't those, Your Honor. We meant to take him back. We took him back. He's been there for the last 4 years ever since. I don't know about one particular employee may have complained about the fact that he got a special treatment, but the company's intention was to bring him back, and he was brought back. And he was given the job that he requested. He's now working, as a parts clerk in the storeroom. We have accommodated this gentleman. And to go back to your question about the baghouse and whether or not there is really any need at all for overtime, Ms. Brennan's office put together an affidavit, and this is Plaintiff's Appendix 597. It shows that in the year 2007, one employee in the baghouse, and there aren't very many, had 50 hours of overtime that year. And there's also evidence in the record that there have been several fires in the baghouse. You can't walk away at 5 o'clock from that job. You simply can't do it.
What about the other evidence showing that some people worked overtime only 2 to 8 hours per year?
Well, I suspect that was right. Probably the least senior person in the department was the one who handled the overtime. It wasn't, it was intermittent work, but you had to be available for it. You have to be available for it. Likewise, on the whole issue of the shift, they have rotating shifts. We all understand that in a manufacturing plant, you have ups and downs in demand, and there are times when you need additional hours, and there has to be need for an additional shift. And if an employee could choose their hours, virtually everyone would choose the day shift. And waiving the requirement for rotating shifts leads to a whole host of problems. If Your Honor, if you focus on that, grievances are filed by people who are unhappy that someone else got special treatment. Senior employees, in effect, lose their seniority because then they're the ones who are required to work the rotating shift. This company thought the rotating shift was an essential job function. Section 7.1 of the CBA, this is Plaintiff's Appendix 531, defines regular shift to include the day shift, the afternoon shift, and the midnight shift. And okay, all job applicants are told when they are interviewed for this position that they are subject to rotating shifts.
Okay. I mean, I because your time is running out, I just want to raise one other point with you. The plaintiffs filed a motion for sanctions, arguing that you failed to comply with Rule 11C2 when you filed the motion for sanctions, which is the requirement using mandatory language, which is must happen, that the motion must not be filed or presented to the court if the defense is withdrawn or appropriately corrected within 21 days after service. When Rule 11 was amended in 1993, this was a very important part of the rule. It was an effort to reduce ancillary Rule 11 litigation. And are they wrong that you did not file the 21-day notice?
They are correct. I would have two things to say.
Why isn't that sanctionable conduct?
Well, it may be grounds for denying a motion.
No, it may be grounds for sanctioning you for failing to allow this whole issue to get off the table because they could have withdrawn the allegation.
Our position is that they waived the 21-day requirement.
That's not what the rule says.
But there's a Seventh Circuit case that addresses that.
The rule says the motion must be made, and they can't waive your failure to comply with that. How can they do that?
Because what happened here was at the summary judgment hearing, after the sanctions motion had been filed, the district court asked the plaintiff whether or not she wanted to proceed in response to the Rule 11 motion or take it up at a later time. And she said no, she was ready to proceed with it. And, Your Honor, the
rules simply cannot work the way they're supposed to if this process doesn't go forward, because it seems to me this is a muddy record on the question whether Global Brass was a separate entity, who was the employer. People throw these names around all over the place. And
Your Honor, if I may, prior to the summary judgment hearing, we had made two or three requests, I believe all of which are in the record. We submitted an affidavit showing that the plaintiff had not been employed by Global Brass and Copper. We filed our response to the summary judgment motion. They did not contest our motion as to Global Brass and Copper. They promised to dismiss Global Brass and Copper. And at the summary judgment hearing, Ms. Brennan announced that she had changed her mind because last night she had found on the internet a lot of generic references to Global Brass and Copper, hiring employees and so forth. Now, this is the internet. This is not a legal document.
Well, Delaware filings are on the internet, too.
Those facts were not known to her at the time she filed the complaint against Global Brass and Copper. That is my point.
Okay, so I just want to point out that your circuit rule 26.1 disclosure does not offer any information about how these various companies are related to one another.
I apologize for that.
And that is not helpful to the court. And my only concern is I've seen over the years many cases in which corporate relationships are quite intertwined. I've seen companies, you know, shift around the, you know, who's the real employer in ways that make it very unclear. So I'm not sure that there's some rule that they're required just to take your word for it. It would have been helpful if you had taken a little time to spell this out.
My fault. I apologize. See that my time is up.
It's waning. Actually, you still have a minute if you want to wrap up.
Address the 4A2 question. I think that the purpose of 4A2 is to address a situation where the district court comes out on the bench and says, I've looked at all the papers and I'm going to grant summary judgment for the defendant, but does not do so. There's no piece of paper. The notice of appeal is filed. Judgment is later entered in accordance with the oral order.
And thank you, counsel.
Sorry.
The case is taken under advisement.